Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true?
They don't think Christianity's true.
They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
How does somebody who served time in prison for attempting to kill his father become a great intellect and a great evangelist for the Christian faith? Someone who debates people everywhere, particularly Muslims, in very dangerous situations. How does that happen? Only the grace of God could make that happen. I'm going to have two guests on today that are going to weave together for you a true story about sin, redemption, and a person who is very steeped in Islam becoming a Christian. In fact, one of my guests you've already heard from before, Dr. Nabil Qureshi, has been on the show before. His new book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, is a bestseller. If you don't have it, you need to have it. But the man that helped lead Nabil to Christ is with us as well. We have not had him on the program before. His name is Dr. David Wood. He's just gotten his PhD in philosophy at Fordham University. He now lives in the Bronx. That is the Bronx, New York, with his wife and four sons. And I'm going to let David tell you a little bit about his history because it's quite riveting. So, David, thanks for being on the show today.
Hey, how's it going, Frank?
It's going great. And I want people to know a little bit about you before we bring Nabil on and talk about the relationship you had with him. Because, as everyone knows, you were very integral in his journey toward Christ. But tell us a little bit about you. You grew up as an atheist. Tell us about your childhood and what happened and why you went to prison and all that.
Well, I don't remember ever believing in God when I was young. Didn't make much of a difference most of the time. Most of the time that I was growing up, but eventually, you know, when people reach the age of 13 and 14, and you know, they start thinking about you know, life and meaning and things like that, did start playing a bigger role. And in my teenage years, I came to believe that you know, things are meaningless in the ultimate sense. I mean, you have this huge universe, and our planet is this little insignificant speck of debris in the universe. And you know, human beings were these sacks of cells running around, thinking that everything is so important. And I started thinking about, you know, morality and why I should do certain things, and I realized that all of the things I'd been told to do or not to do was all just a bunch of nonsense, right? So, I mean, you know, society put those things into me when it's, you know, don't kill or don't steal or things like that. Those were rules that have been sort of brainwashed into me. And, you know, if you can imagine a situation where you get brainwashed into doing something, it could be something harmless. But if you find out that you've been controlled by someone else, you get sort of you'd be upset about it, that you were controlled by someone else. So I started believing that, you know, everything I've been told about right and wrong was had been forced into me. And so I started acting out against it. I thought that, you know, the way to sort of cleanse or purify myself from everything I've been brainwashed into thinking, you know, you kind of have to do the opposite. And so I started doing the opposite. And a lot of things happened along the way, but, you know, at the end of it, I tried to kill my dad with a hammer, and I went to jail for that, and I was in a jail cell, and I started persecuting this Christian, and his name was Randy, and I saw him sitting on his bunk one day reading his Bible. And he was a pretty interesting individual. There'd be a fight in the jail block we were in, and he wouldn't even look up from his Bible. And I would ask him later. I said, "Hey, what'd you think of that? Why weren't you looking at that fight?" And he'd say, "Because I was I was praying that it would stop. And so it was an interesting guy, but one day I told Randy that the reason he was reading his Bible is because he's born in the United States, and that people like him believe whatever they're taught to believe, which was pretty hypocritical. I believed what I was taught, that the world formed on its own, and that, you know, the Bible's a bunch of nonsense. I believed what I was taught to believe. But I was pointing a finger at him, saying he was taught to believe what he believes, and, you know, so he's not a very deep thinker. And something weird happened. This Christian in a jail cell just started destroying me when we were arguing. And in case anyone's wondering, Randy had turned himself in for 21 felonies that he committed earlier, and so Randy started just crushing me in arguments. It'd be arguments about, you know, God or the Bible or something like this, and I was realizing that I didn't know as much as I thought I knew. And after a while, I got into a pretty weird fasting battle with Randy, where he would fast for long periods of time, and I would just try to fast a couple more days than he did. I'd never fasted a day in my life until this guy went 7 days on nothing but water, and I said, all right, I'm going 10, and I did it. I did it on pure rage at beating a Christian.
Wow.
And eventually they thought I was trying to starve myself to death, because I went from about 230 pounds down to about 150 pounds. Fasting against a Christian, because I couldn't beat him in argument, so I was just going to beat him some other way. And so they put me in this camera cell where they could watch me if they think I'm trying to kill myself. And back there, I was, all right, I'm gonna study all this stuff, and I'm going to get back out, and I'm going to destroy this guy. And so I was getting Bible studies, and they have great libraries in jail, by the way, and people donate books and stuff. They have all stuff. So I was studying and went through a lot of material, and eventually came to realize that what I believed about Jesus was all wrong.
And you became a Christian then at what age, and at what age did you get out of the prison?
I was 20 years old when I became a Christian, and I guess I was about 24 when I got out of prison.
And then you go to Old Dominion University, and you run into Nabil Qureshi.
Yeah.
Well, let me bring Nabil in, because we just got a couple minutes before the break. Nabil, what was the first time you saw David Wood?
Well, the first time I saw David was during a practice for our forensics and debate team. We were both on the public speaking team, and David and I were more or less new. I was a freshman. David was a sophomore, and I guess we didn't really get along with the leadership of the forensics and debate team, so both David and I were suggesting certain changes, and we immediately realized we kind of thought along the same lines, and when we got to talking with each other, we realized that we both had a strong faith, and we just kind of hit it off.
Now, what was it that intrigued you about David when you realized he was a Christian and you, of course, were a Muslim? What was different about him than most other Christians you met?
Well, you know, most Christians I had met simply were unable to talk intelligently about their faith. Almost any time I asked anyone a question about Christianity, of course, there's much about Christianity that conflicts with the basic teachings of Islam. So whenever I asked a question, generally people would appeal to divine mystery or to faith, which was their substitute word for ignorance. And they wouldn't answer my questions. David was the first guy I ran into who not only lived his faith out before me instead of something he just did Sunday mornings, but he also was able to discuss the issues of biblical reliability, issues of textual transmission, stuff like that, combined with death and resurrection of Jesus, etc. So long story short, he was the first Christian equipped with answers to my question.
And we get back from the break, we're going to see how this newfound friendship led to the salvation of Nabil, and of course further deepened David's faith as well. And if you want to learn more about David, go to Acts 17 Apologetics on YouTube. You'll see several excellent videos from David. Acts 17 Apologetics on YouTube. And of course, for Nabil, go to rzim.org. For Ravi Zacharias International Ministries.org. I'm Frank Turek, back in 2 minutes. Don't touch that dial. Welcome back to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. If you're low on the FM dial, go no further. If you're looking for NPR, just stay right here. We're actually going to tell you the truth here. That's our intent anyway. And the truth is that Christianity is indeed true, as my friend Nabil Qureshi found out by examining the evidence with the help of Dr. David Wood, who we both have Nabil and David on the phone with us today for this edition of Cross Examined. And we're talking about how they interacted together to arrive at the fact that Nabil moved from a very strong position in the Muslim faith to now a very strong position in the Christian faith. Nabil works with Ravi Zacharias. For some of you, most of you out here know who Ravi is. Whatever Ravi says, God listens to. And Nabil is traveling the world with Ravi right now, doing apologetics in some very difficult areas. And David has just finished his PhD at Fordham University in philosophy. And he has several excellent videos at the website on YouTube called Acts 17 Apologetics. He's also the contributor to a number of books out there. So David Wood is somebody you've got to know as well. Now, David, when you first met Nabil, what did you think of him?
Well, we met at the school, but we didn't really start talking until we were sharing a hotel room for a school trip, and of course I'm thinking ahead of time, hey, am I put into the room with a Muslim for a reason, right? Am I on this trip? Is Nabil on this team at this university for a reason? Is this God's providence here? But I'm not sure. And I didn't want to come across as a hate monger or something like that. So I was actually praying, God, if you want us to have a conversation, please let him start it, because I might blurt out something about Muhammad or something like that that upsets him, and he'll throw a tantrum or what. So if we're going to have if you want us to have this conversation, please let him start it. And it was a couple of minutes went by, and Nabil says there in the hotel room, he looks over at me and says, "So, are you a hardcore Christian?" And that's when we started.
And how did you respond?
Yes.
That was it. Yes.
Yeah,
next question.
Yes, I am.
Now, I know you probably can't recall the exact conversation that went on, but how did this relationship progress, and what were some of the things you discussed along the way? And were you at any time thinking that maybe Nabil had a good point, and maybe Islam seemed plausible?
Well, I never thought that Islam seemed plausible. Islam is interesting in that, like Christianity, it makes certain truth claims. It makes claims that we can actually go out and investigate, and so it's better than certain other systems that aren't making claims that can be investigated, and you just have to, accept them or reject them. And with that said, if you weren't going to be a Christian, Islam would have a lot going for it in terms of, it still believes in God, it still believes in biblical prophets, and, still believes in a standard of morality. So it would be better than other systems in those senses. But, if you start going through the history of Muhammad and the arguments that he gave, really, really no comparison if you've been through the evidence for Christianity. So I was never tempted to consider Islam as a serious option. But Nabil's really smart and very good at arguing and so on. So it's not like I don't care what the topic is. You're not going to go in there and just maul him in a discussion. He's going to put up a heck of a fight, and he did for years.
Now, Nabil, at what point did you think that David had a good point, that you started to evaluate, maybe there's more to this Christianity thing than I've been taught?
Well, it doesn't happen overnight. And even when a good point is made that you can't refute, it's generally not something that dawns on you and says, I can't refute this, therefore it must be true. you generally deal with some cognitive dissonance. You deal with some internal frustration, and you think, I just can't argue this point, but I know I'm right. Mm. That's usually where you end up, and it's not until you have enough of these changes, enough of these kinds of discussions where you have some tectonic shifts in your thinking. And so it's not just point by point. It needs to be like a constellation of points where you realize over time, wait a minute, perhaps he is right. And so we started talking about the Bible. We talked about its reliability. And he would make one point after another showing, look, Nabil, there's no place where doctrine could have been intentionally inserted into the New Testament. We'd talk about Jesus' death, and he'd say, look, Nabil, categorically, uniformly, all the evidence points to the fact that Jesus died on the cross, contrary to what the Quran says. And I would battle each of these points, but when the accumulated weight was so heavy and I realized it's not just one point that I'm losing here, it's pretty much the whole argument that is in favor of David. It was at that time that I realized the case for Christianity was really strong. I would say that took about 3 years.
3 years, and how often did you and David interact on this? Was this a continual thing during the school year, or did you just see each other occasionally?
It was continual. David and I signed up for courses together pretty regularly, and I'm talking about during the school year. We signed up for stuff like genetics and chemistry together, and then even in the summer, we signed up for organic chemistry together. I would come hang out at his place. He would come hang out at mine, and invariably, we would discuss religion at some point. Our discussions were pretty constant, it took time for me to realize that the weight of the arguments was in his favor. And while that was happening, I know a lot of people who have frustration when they're talked to Muslims about Christ. They say, well, my friend just became even more devout. Whenever I was discussing Christ with him, he just became more devout. I would say what's happening in that situation is what happened with me. I was trying to resolve this cognitive dissonance by outwardly acting more Muslim. And it wasn't a show. It was, you know, the whole honor-shame mindset makes you put your inward feelings outwardly. And so I was trying to act more Muslim. I was leading Friday prayers at that time. I was teaching Muslim youth the basics of Aqidah. That's what I did in order to resolve the internal dissonance from David's argumentation.
Now, David, what qualifications did you have at this point? Did you have any formal training in Christian apologetics, or were you self-taught? How did you know the answers and the evidence that that you presented to Nabil?
Well, I spent several years when I was in prison reading apologetics, mostly reading the Bible and books about the Bible and so on, but also apologetics, and you run into several Muslims in prison who are actively trying to convert people. So I knew a little bit about Islam, not through serious study, but I actually started studying Islam before I started studying Christianity, not in depth the way I would, when I have much longer interactions with Nabil, but just for your listeners, it's not something that you have to know everything in an exchange, because if Nabil brings up something and I don't know a lot about it, I'll get back to you next week and I'm going to go study that. And that's a good habit to get into. If you're talking to somebody and they bring up a point, that sounds like an interesting point. I don't want to give you an answer off the top of my head. Let's get together a week from now, put all our information together, and then let's get back together again and get to the bottom of this.
Frank, I'd like to emphasize that David actually had a pretty rudimentary knowledge of Islam when we started discussing. He actually gave a talk. We were in the public speaking team together. He gave a talk on the excellent qualities of Muhammad, because he didn't know the history of Muhammad at that time. It wasn't until we started discussing issues a few years later that he started bringing some stuff up. So it was a long process even for David to learn some of this stuff, and then for him to bring it up with me took even longer.
So you were saying that you knew some of the negative side of Muhammad before David did?
No, I didn't know either. David ultimately showed it to me, but he didn't know it when we started discussing things. He learned it along the way.
That's an important point. Most of what I knew from Islam, I'd taken I'd taken courses in religion, a course on Islam, and so on. And I was reading modern books. I would read a modern book by a modern author who grows up in the West about Islam. And Nabil is learning Islam through a more modern tradition as well, who are, you know, a lot of the negative details about Muhammad get sifted out in both systems, right? You get sifted out, and you don't bring these things up about Muhammad if you're a good Muslim. And if you're writing a modern book about Muhammad, you don't bring those things up either. So it's actually when we started talking about Islam, and we say, all right, let's go back to what the Muslim sources say. That's when you get all kinds of shocking details.
And some of those sources, I think, are from, 100, 150 years after Muhammad. Is that right, Nabil?
The earliest biography on Muhammad's life that we have is Ibn Ishaq's Sirat Rasulullah, and that came about 150 years after he died. It is replete with things that I would not have considered authentic regarding Muhammad. There's just a lot of stuff in there that, tortures and assassinations and et cetera, that even though it's the earliest biography, as a Muslim, I would have rejected those stories out of hand. And I'd rather turn to books of hadith like Sahih al-Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, which are actually 200 to 250 years after Muhammad died.
Are you saying then that the biographer of Muhammad, 150 years after his death, do you think he had it more accurate than the hadith, which were later?
It's interesting you should ask that question. We actually don't have Ibn Ishaq's work itself. What we have is there was a man named al-Baqai who was Ibn Ishaq's student. He had a student named Ibn Hisham. Ibn Hisham is the one who saved the biography, for the most part, that Ibn Ishaq wrote. But when he saved it, he said, I have removed portions which my teacher said were inaccurate or I found unbelievable. So what we have is actually an edited version of something that early Muslims saw had inaccuracies in it.
And the edited version still has many negative aspects of Muhammad, correct?
Many, many. That I was shocked to find out when I was Muslim. I simply couldn't believe them, and that's why I turned to the hadith instead. But when I did that, I realized those stories aren't just relegated to Ibn Ishaq. They're found throughout the early Islamic tradition.
We're talking to Nabil Qureshi, former Muslim, now a Christian, largely because of the help and witness of David Wood, also my guest. Nabil's book is Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, A Devout Muslim Encounters Christianity. And David Wood is a new doctor of philosophy. His YouTube channel, Acts 17 Apologetics. More in just 2 minutes. I'm Frank Turek. Welcome back to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. Twitter account is @Frank_Turek, T-U-R-E-K, @_Turek, T-U-R-E-K. Also, we're running up against, we've got too many Facebook friends now, so we have a public page. It's Dr. Frank Turek. The Facebook address, Dr. Frank Turek. If you would like us there, that would be very helpful because we can't add any more people on the personal account. So appreciate it if you guys would do that. Our website, crossexamined.org. The website of Nabil Qureshi, one of my guests today, is rzim.org. You need to know about that. You also need to go to David Wood's YouTube page. He's revamping his entire Acts 17 website. So for now, go to Acts 17 Apologetics under YouTube. You'll find some fantastic videos there. David's a very clear thinker. And David, you have debated Muslims. You've been involved in, I think, about 40 debates so far. How did you get involved in this, and what are some of the venues at which you've debated?
Well, after Nabil became a Christian, I actually thought, hey, I'm done with Islam. I'm a former atheist. I'm more interested in having discussions with atheists and refuting those kinds of objections. But after Nabil became a Christian, people started, Muslims don't like it when a Muslim converts to Christianity. So some people wanted to, I guess, expose him and expose me on stage for, show everyone I don't know what I'm talking about. Nabil was, he was dumb for converting and so on. So they started challenging us to debates, and we started debating that way. And it was somewhere along the way where, you know, for a while I still thought, you know, hey, I'm going to be doing something other than Islam. But it was somewhere along the way I realized that, you know, that there are tons of Christian apologists who are responding to atheism, and there's not a lot responding to Islam. So maybe I'm in a you know, maybe I need to stick with this. And So I mean, I've debated most of the places, of course, here in the United States. I just did a debate recently in Paris, France, which is weird because I don't speak French, and so I had to debate through a translator, and in the UK and so on.
And Nabil has participated in some of these debates with you?
Yeah. Some of them we would arrange multiple debates. So Nabil would do a debate on the deity of Christ, and I would do a debate on the identity of Muhammad, and it would be set for the, you know, one, you know, back to back or something like that. But we've also done two on two debates where it's you know, two representatives of Islam and then us.
Nabil, I don't think I've seen any of these debates on YouTube. I'm sure I can find them up there. What is David's strengths in these debates, in your opinion?
Well, David doesn't pull any punches. If an issue is addressed, David will give the hard-hitting information, even if it means some people will end up feeling uncomfortable. And I think that's very necessary. You know, a lot of people say, especially when we were ministering together, they would say to us, you guys aren't Christ-like in your approach. You're too confrontational. And fact of the matter is, there were times when Christ was rather confrontational. It was with those people who needed it.
Absolutely.
And when I was a Muslim, no one was confrontational with me, and I just felt that was because Islam was superior. And David was the first guy who challenged me on some of these things. And yeah, some of the truths were very hard to swallow, but I needed to hear them. And that's one of David's strengths. He knows the sources well. He knows the issue well, the landscape. And so doing a debate with him was just phenomenal. One of the best debates that we did together, I think, was one that we actually participated in together. It was a two-on-two on Is Islam a Religion of Violence? If you watch that on YouTube, it was in 2009, you'll get a good sense for what we're talking about.
Now, is it true that the basic Islamic mindset would respect confrontation rather than being kind of the Western culture kind of meek and humble kind of approach that many Christians take? Do they respect a more confrontational approach generally?
I would say what they respect is confidence and assertiveness. You know, the confrontational attitude basically arises out of that. And if you go to the Middle East, just watch some talk shows, you'll have people yelling at each other. You'll have people, you know, getting out of their chairs and getting upset with one another. It's kind of how things happen in the Middle East. You have people who are very passionate. So it's definitely not shunned confrontational attitudes as much as it is in the West. But I would say what's really respected is the confidence and the boldness. That is something that's a highly respected trait.
Now, David, when you're debating with Nabil, what kind of strengths does he bring to the table, particularly over the issue of Islam, other than obviously he's a former Muslim himself? What kind of skills does he bring, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, Nabil's he's an all-around great communicator. He's really sharp, and you know, he's a great presenter. So when you get up there, you know, lots of debaters and speakers have had the problem where you know, the speaker isn't very, you know, he's not very engaging, and, you know, you might have great arguments, but you're just boring everyone to death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And your opponent might be, might not know what he's talking about, might have horrible arguments, but he's a much livelier speaker. And, you know, a lot of the famous Muslim debaters, I would say, are just their arguments are horrible. They're beyond horrible, but they're usually great communicators, and they pick opponents who aren't great communicators. And so it doesn't matter what the arguments are. If you're looking for someone who's engaging, and as Nabil pointed out, someone who's confident, you know, the Muslim speaker can overpower, his opponent that way. And yeah, you can't do that to someone who is a good communicator and who is going to be engaging and so on. And so, yeah, Nabil is a good foil to some of the standard Muslim apologists.
Now, David, I know it depends on the topic, but let's suppose you're going up against a Muslim with regard to which is the authority, the Bible or the Quran. What arguments do you think are most persuasive, maybe just one or two of them, that you really want to hit on in a conversation with another Muslim? What would you bring up to really get the other Muslim to begin to doubt maybe the Quran or his or her worldview?
Yeah, if I could change one thing in the world of apologetics, it would be this, and that's that on this issue of the Bible and the Quran, probably the most important thing to get your mind around is that the Quran affirms the Bible. And lots of people don't know this, and when a Muslim says the Bible's been corrupted, a Christian who's, you know, been trained in sort of, you know, apologetics towards atheists will start responding to the Muslim like he responds to an atheist. Ah, let's go to textual criticism, let's go to, well, guess what? The Muslim's claim has nothing to do with textual criticism and this or that. His claim about the Bible being corrupted is based on the fact that the Quran affirms the scriptures of the Christians and Jews, and yet the scriptures of the Christians and Jews do not line up with the Quran, therefore our Bible's been corrupted. It must have been corrupted. The problem is that's not what the Quran says. The Quran doesn't say, go to the Bible, but it's been corrupted, or don't go to the Bible because it's been destroyed or anything like that. Muhammad actually told his followers, this is in the Quran, it's chapter 7, verse 157, that we find Muhammad written down in our scriptures, in the Torah and the Gospel. And what you find if you go through these passages is that the Quran affirms not just the original inspiration of the Torah and the Gospel, the Quran affirms the inspiration, the preservation, and the authority of the Torah and the Gospel. And so mentioned chapter 7, 157, obviously if Christians and Jews find Muhammad mentioned in our scriptures, we have the scriptures. But chapter 3, verses 3 through 4 mention that the Torah and the Gospel were revealed by Allah. Verses like chapter 18, verse 27 say that no one can change Allah's words. And then a very interesting passage, chapter 5, verse 47, orders Christians to judge by the Gospel. It says, let the people of the Gospel judge, that's Christians, let the people of the Gospel judge by what Allah hath revealed therein. And it says, if we don't judge by what Allah has revealed in the Gospel, then we're no better than those who rebel. So think about that. A Muslim says, don't judge, don't go to your Bible, your Bible's been corrupted. The Quran says, judge by the Gospel or you're in rebellion against Allah. And what this does, when you put all these passages together, it sort of puts Muslims in an inescapable dilemma. Either we have the inspired, preserved, authoritative Word of God, or we don't. It's one or the other. If what Christians have is the inspired, preserved, authoritative Word of God, then Islam is false, because Islam doesn't line up with what we have. If, on the other hand, what Christians have is not the inspired, preserved, authoritative Word of God, then Islam is still false, because Islam says we do have the inspired, preserved, authoritative Word of Allah. So whether the Bible is the Word of God or not, Islam is false. So Islam needs to be set aside as an option. And that's what happens with this weird situation that by affirming our book, Islam has put itself in this situation, because Islam affirms scriptures that it clearly contradicts, and it contradicts on some of the most fundamental Christian doctrines, Jesus' death, resurrection, and deity. So that's the message that I would get across to Muslims. It's not, hey, let's just look at the textual history of our book, and let's look at the textual history of your book. That's important. I'm not saying don't do that. I'm saying there's a deeper issue here in that, you know, if an atheist says, I don't believe in miracles, well, we're going to have to start talking about the existence of God and things like that. If a Muslim says, hey, I don't believe in miracles, it's a completely different kind of argument. I say, what are you talking about? You're a Muslim. I will show you verses in the Quran that say that prophets performed miracles. So how can you not believe in miracles? So there are different kinds of responses to different kinds of groups. And when we're talking about Muslims who, almost any Muslim you run into will tell you that the Bible's been corrupted, one of the most important points to get across is that's not what your Quran says. And if you are telling me that, if you're telling me that the Bible's been corrupted, that's not just a problem for me, that's a problem for you too.
That's David Wood, ladies and gentlemen. You can see he gets fired up about this stuff. Now, we got just about a minute before the break, Nabil, so just give me a short answer, and then we'll get a more expansive answer from you on the other side of the break. And that is, when he brought this argument up to you, how did you respond? What did you think?
Well, when it comes to biblical reliability, I more or less didn't think that the Bible posed any threat to Islamic theology because after... for me, the main issue was, did Jesus claim to be God or not? Right. You know, I was pretty confident that even if the Bible were still well preserved, Jesus never claimed to be God in the Gospels. And so I was willing to concede the argument. Now, one thing that David didn't do that I wish he had was to bring up the issues of the textual nature of the Quran. I do think that's very important for us to discuss with Muslims.
Well, let's take a look at that right after the break and get more on Nabil's response to David's argument. No matter what, whether the Bible's true or not, Islam can't be true. And we'll rehash that right after the break. I'm Frank Turek. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. My guests, David Wood and Nabil Qureshi. Islam versus Christianity, which is true, if either? We're talking to Dr. David Wood, who was instrumental in bringing Nabil Qureshi to the saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. And we have Nabil on the line as well, whose new book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, is a great read. It's a bestseller on Amazon. Nabil works with Ravi Zacharias at rzim.org. And David's YouTube website is Acts 17 Apologetics, all one word. You need to check that out. Now, before the break, Nabil, we were talking, or David had mentioned textual criticism a little bit. You know, how do we know that we have the original text of the Quran and the same thing is true with the New Testament and the entire Bible? Let's talk about the Quran for a minute. Are there any textual problems with the Quran?
What I would say is Muslims generally derive the confidence of their faith on two points. One is the prophethood of Muhammad. The other is the inspiration of the Quran. And a lot of the apologetics focuses on Muhammad, which Muslims generally just take that personally. They see that as you attacking their prophet. And of course, Muhammad is the symbol for Islam in many people's minds. And so it's seen as a personal attack. For some reason, Christian apologists have ignored the issues or not explored the issues with the Quran. And so Muslims have this supreme confidence in the perfect preservation of the Quran. And to understand this, you have to understand that Muslims often see the Quran as not the way Christians see the Bible, which was a process of inspiration where God guided the writing of the text through human hands. For example, you know, Paul wrote 1 Corinthians. We can say Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, but no Muslim would dare say Muhammad wrote the Quran. That would be very offensive to Muslim eyes and ears. So Muslims have the supreme confidence in the word-for-word, almost facsimile revelation of the Quran from heaven to this earth. And what I didn't know, what I didn't look into until the very last stages of me coming to Christ, was that the Quran has a pockmarked history with its text. For one, it's written in the Islamic records itself that all the earliest Quranic manuscripts were intentionally burned by the third caliph, Uthman. It's not that some happened to be lost, but all of the earliest textual manuscripts of the Quran, were intentionally destroyed. But when you look into the scholastic textual criticism of the Quran, another thing that people often don't note, and this is only just coming to the fore, this is cutting-edge stuff in scholarship and apologetics, is that the Quran was never intended to be a written book. The Quran was designed to be an oral book, which is why you can have the doctrine of abrogation, which is why you have this concept of multiple ways of reciting the Quran. And we don't have the time to go into these details here, but the Arabic of the time when the Quran was revealed was simply not able to sustain the text of the Quran. The Arabic was still in its nascent phases. Here's a key point to know. There was no such thing as an Arabic book when Muhammad was supposedly on the scene. Muhammad was born 570 AD. By the year 610, when the Quran is supposedly being revealed, there was no such thing as a book in Arabic. Nothing like that had ever been written. Arabic was too new to the scene. It was over a few centuries that, because of the Quranic text, people wanted to learn how to write it down, that Arabic script was developed.
So what was it written in originally then? If there was no Arabic book, was it a primitive form of Arabic, or was it written in another language? What was it?
Okay. It was a primitive form of Arabic. It was called the textum defectivum. I'm sorry, the scriptum defectivum. They had not been able to capture various inflections. Certain letters were still being standardized. You had vocalics, how to recite things, and dots, the nukat. Those had not been standardized or invented yet. For a long time, they hadn't. What you had was, at the time, Arabic merchants were able to write receipts, basically very small notes. And on top of graves, you would have, you know, basic indications of who was buried in a tomb. But that was it. The Quran is the first Arabic book. And so to even actually say that the Quran was intended to be a book that would be perfectly preserved is a category fallacy. It simply wasn't that kind of composition.
I can already see the Muslim response to this, though, Nabil. It's a miracle! there was no such thing as a formal Arabic language or books, but this is the first one, and Muhammad did it. Do you think they might say something like that, David, or how would they respond to something like that?
It's very interesting as to why the Quran was put together into a book to begin with, because this is according to the Muslim sources, but... It's a huge problem for Islam and for the claim that the Quran has been perfectly preserved. But Abu Bakr, who took over as leader when Muhammad died, he apparently came up with a brilliant idea. Since the Quran is something that people are memorizing, it's something that they're transmitting orally, and Allah, according to chapter 15, verse 9 of the Quran, promises to preserve the text. Abu Bakr apparently had this brilliant idea of, I'll take all the people who have the Quran memorized and send them out into battle, and I'll have an invincible army because God's going to protect them. Otherwise, the Quran will be destroyed. Well, uh-huh. a bunch of these guys got slaughtered, and passages of the Quran were lost. And so the reason for putting the Quran together into a book to begin with was to say, hey, we need to not lose anymore. And I'll go ahead and quote this real quick. This is from Ibn Abi Daud's Kitab al-Masahif. So many of the passages of the Quran that were sent down were known by those who died in battle, but they were not known by those who survived them, nor were they written down, nor had Abu Bakr, Umar, or Uthman by that time collected the Quran, nor were they found with even one person after them. So this is a Muslim source saying that passages of the Quran were lost, and that the point of putting the Quran together into a book was so that they wouldn't lose anymore. And so it's mind-boggling that it's taken as standard Islamic orthodoxy that any Muslim will tell you the Quran's been perfectly preserved, when the only reason we have a physical copy of the Quran was because so much of it was lost.
Now,
the extent of the misinformation here is mind-boggling. I mean, I just want to emphasize, Muslims draw an immense amount of confidence from the idea that no letter or jot or dot had been changed from the Quran since it came to Muhammad till today. And the fact is, they hadn't even invented the dots yet when the Quran was initially written.
Well, so Nabil, where would our audience go to find this in writing, this kind of or these kind of facts about the Quran and the textual history of the Quran? Where would they go? Because I would assume that in the Muslim world, this is taboo to even talk about, correct?
Absolutely. This is, and I also want to say that this is brand new stuff. You're not going to find many Christian apologetic books talking about this. The first and foremost person I would suggest on this is Dr. Keith Small, graduated from the London School of Theology. He's a consultant at Oxford University now on their Quranic manuscripts. He wrote a book called Textual Criticism and Quran Manuscripts, published by Lexington Press. That's where I would go. If you want a basic level of this, he wrote a book called Holy Books Have a History. Keith Small, Holy Books Have a History. and he breaks it down for lay people. And that's
let me add. That's if you're looking for manuscript information, textual history of the Quran. If someone just wants some of the Muslim sources that are saying that passages of the Quran were lost or that verses of the Quran were lost according to the Hadith and stuff, rather than on a manuscript tradition, you can actually go to my blog, which is answeringmuslims.com, and click on the Quran link, and I have a list of those sources from Bukhari and other sources where they talk about the early transmission of the Quran.
And if there are any Muslims listening right now, just go to Sahih Bukhari, Volume 6, Book 61, and you will learn a lot.
Answeringmuslims.com, and give us that reference again, Nabil.
Sahih Bukhari, Volume 6, Book 61.
Is that from the Hadith?
It is the most trusted collection of Hadith, and the whole book describes the process of the collection of the Quran, just like what David was saying.
And to any Muslims who take them up on that and then go through what those passages say about the history of the Quran, I would invite them to then ask themselves, why haven't my leaders been telling me this? And why haven't my leaders, which have read this, why have they been telling me that the Quran has been perfectly preserved?
Well, that is an excellent question. And we've got just a couple of minutes left, gentlemen. So I want to just leave you each with a minute to advise people out there who are interacting with Muslims. Just give them a quick to do or not to do when you're interacting with Muslims. Let's start with you, David.
Well, you should be in this for the long haul. You know, a lot of evangelists have this mentality of, it's got to be like a Billy Graham crusade. You give a message, and then thousands of people come down and convert. And it's not going to be like that with a Muslim. If you ever talk to a Muslim and just present the gospel right there, and he converts immediately, it's because other people have laid a lot of groundwork there.
Right.
And so get your mind around that these Muslims have been raised with a lot of objections to Christianity and a lot of false information about the Quran and about Muhammad, and it can take a while. It can take a while to get through that material, but it's worth it. It's worth it. There are people created in the image of God who've been led astray, who've been led away from that one God, and God gives us the opportunity to play a role in sharing the truth with them.
All right, Nabil, we got about 30 seconds. Go ahead, sir.
Just to pick up from that, love your Muslim neighbor with everything you have. Don't see them as a project. If you're sharing the gospel with them, see them as, someone who God has created and has placed in your life for you to share the love of Christ with them. Don't come antagonistically. They're not your enemy. The devil is your enemy. So love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, and love your Muslim neighbor as yourself.
All right, that's Nabil Qureshi and David Wood. Go to answeringmuslims.com for David Wood. Go to rzim.org for Nabil Qureshi and get Nabil's new book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, A Devout Muslim Encounters Christianity. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Frank Turek. I'll see you again next week. God bless.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.